If America is losing in Afghanistan, there must be someone to blame. Not al-Qaeda, and even the Taliban is losing its cachet. There must be someone.
Pakistan.
Eureka! Right next door, they're our ally, they're politically unstable, and they cooperate with terrorists.
We're the very best FBI and bad guys. We're riding to the car. You might come
Go back to Islamabad until you can behave. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 12th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. Attacks over the weekend in Pakistan. We'll assess the security of Pakistan, Afghanistan's neighbor. And Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen has the highlights of the sports weekend, plus inheritance battles. You don't have to have $180 million at stake to...
You just have to have a crystal figurine.
Broke. Yes, that's right. You'll find out. Inheritance problems in families who aren't as rich as the Astors.
But first, Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. So, Marcus, can we conceivably move this war from Afghanistan into Pakistan?
Well, I think a lot of people are asking that question, but I think what we have to realize is that you can't separate these conflicts. You cannot separate Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I think you'll remember the Bush administration said the reason we didn't have a policy toward Afghanistan when 9/11 happened was because you could not divorce the two. We still have not figured out how to join them together yet, and we must.
Marcus Mabry, we'll be back with you in just a moment. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, just in the last hour, a woman is among the newest winners of the Nobel Prize for Economics. It's the first in the history of the Economics Prize. Two Americans are sharing it. We're getting new reports that North Korea has test-fired two short-range missiles off its eastern coast. A South Korean news agency has that story.
Staying abroad in Pakistan, 41 are dead after an attack on a military convoy in the country's northwest. This comes after a raid on the country's army headquarters on Saturday. And back in the U.S., Congress is off for the Columbus Day holiday, but tomorrow the Senate Finance Committee is set to vote on its health care plan. Our partner, The New York Times, has a page one story on illegal immigration this morning. The Times reports the U.S. still has no reliable system for verifying whether or not foreign visitors have left the country after their legal visas expire. And worry about H1N1 or swine flu is apparently causing the public to request seasonal flu vaccine in record numbers. Some doctors are reporting shortages.
Michael Jackson's first posthumous song is out today. It's called This Is It, and it features backup vocals by his brothers. And in baseball, quickly, the Yankees and the Los Angeles Angels won their playoff series in the American League yesterday. They'll face off in the American League Championship Series. The Phillies now lead the Rockies in the NL contest that's still up for grabs, 2-1.
Wall Street gained a little bit on Friday. The Dow's going to open at 98.65. The S&P starts trading at 10.71, and the NASDAQ is going to start out at 21.39. So we're asking you today, President Obama has a few months to write his speech, his acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize. And we're asking you, what should he say? If you were President Obama's speechwriter, what would you have him say when he accepted his Peace Prize? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Thank you. It's really nice. I really appreciate it a lot. Thank you.
That's not a great impression, John.
I'm not doing an impression. I'm just thanking
you. I'm glad, because that wasn't good.
It would be much...
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective. What's going on?
It's Monday. That means it's time to talk about what's on the agenda for this weekend. Joining us is...
Did you hear a deadline? Did you hear a deadline yesterday? Did you hear
I did not hear
deadline?
A deadline. I didn't hear a deadline, right, and that's what's conspicuously missing. So, Marcus, maybe we ought to talk to you about deadlines today. Marcus is the international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and Nick Childs from our partner, the BBC. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So, yesterday, President Obama was at the Human Rights Campaign National Dinner, well, Saturday night, actually. And, you know, one of the things that was remarkable to me, first of all, was that we actually haven't seen a president at one of these in more than a decade. I think the last time a president spoke at one of these was President Clinton in 1997. But that wasn't the big news. This was the big news.
I will end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's my commitment to you.
It got a standing ovation, lots of applause, but he said, I will end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He didn't say when.
So no deadline.
Right.
In front of the largest gay rights group in the country.
Right. Right, yeah.
Well, you know, we at the New York Times obviously are big fans of deadlines as journalists. But this is a president who has avoided them as much as he could. And when he actually ever embraced a deadline, when he talked about, for instance, getting health care reform legislation by, last summer, he failed. So this is a president who will never probably make that mistake again.
And Gitmo, he gave a deadline for that. That's not looking good either.
Absolutely. So I think he probably knows better by now, number one. Number two, he has other stuff to do. And this is an issue that has often been raised in the LGBT community. Those who say, well, he has health care reform to do. He's got Middle East peace. He's got, you know, all these other issues to tackle. And some in the LGBT community think that that's fair, and the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community. Others think, well, why should equality wait?
This is a Massachusetts Congressman, Barney Frank. He's openly gay, and he seemed pretty skeptical about moving forward on this kind of thing.
Somebody said, do you think people on the mall are going to be putting pressure on Congress? I said, no, the only thing they're going to be putting pressure on is the grass. I mean, members of Congress respond to constituents who communicate to them that this is an interest people have.
So he wasn't real impressed by the effect that the gay rights march in Washington could have had. He says the only thing that might change them is people calling in. Do you think it's possible that President Obama can get this through?
Well, Barney Frank is, you know, one of those members of the group that thinks that patience is called for. He's not one of those people who believes that, well, you know, why should equality wait? And then there's a famous civil rights saying, that when it comes to equality, well, you know, when it came to African-American equality, for instance, when does the devil give you the right time? Meaning it's never the right time for you to demand your equality if you're an oppressed minority group. Barney Frank is certainly a member of the kind of HRC wing, the Human Rights Campaign wing, which is not, that was the wing with the dinner on Saturday night. Which is different from the younger, for the most part, that marched on Sunday. And those younger people, many of them were kind of shocked by the whole marriage fiasco in California and the fact that Proposition 8 passed and lesbian and gays were the right to marry was removed from lesbian and gay Californians. And so those young people were shocked by the fact that they thought they were equal, a lot of them. And it was kind of, for many 20-somethings especially, a kind of shock to the system.
Well, quickly, Marcus, do you think this moves through the week? Is this something that Obama's going to have to answer for this week, or is it a one-day story? He certainly mended his fences with this constituency that was skeptical of him.
I think we'll hear more from the people who were most skeptical, meaning the younger wing of the gay rights movement versus the older wing. And I think they'll probably have something to say about how he didn't do enough on Saturday night.
Okay, so Nick, let's move to Afghanistan now. We're seeing a lot of pressure really mounting on President Obama to finally make a decision about whether or not he's going to send more troops into Afghanistan. Here's Carl Levin talking on Meet the Press.
General McChrystal said a number of things, not just that he needs more resources, whatever that number is. He also says we need a new strategy and that is even more important than the resources. Those are McChrystal's own words. He also says deliberate, take the right amount of time to think this thing through.
So, Nick, the president is definitely taking his time. How much more time does he have before he can announce this new strategy?
Well, time, I think, is of the essence, certainly. And he and the administration are battling the concern that deliberation is beginning to look like, to some extent, disunity, disarray, and dithering, even. And we've had Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, talking to us, trying to defend that and saying, we have got to get this as right as humanly possible. I think essentially because most people, most political commentators as well, probably think that this is the last ask. Public opinion on both sides of the Atlantic and to some extent in Afghanistan too are wondering why you haven't got the strategy right after 8 years, and this is the last opportunity to do that.
Well, since you mentioned Hillary Clinton, Nick Childs of the BBC, she's actually in Moscow today. She's on a tour through Europe and Russia. She's trying to sell Obama's new strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. That tells me that maybe the administration knows what the new strategy is. Is she off selling a new strategy that we don't know the details of yet?
I think the devil is the detail. There is a sense of the strategy hasn't changed, but what is still at issue very much is how to put it into practice, essentially, and it's the implementation question, and that's where you get this balance between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Is it right to continue to concentrate and focus more effort on Afghanistan? How much does Pakistan figure in it, and how do you deal with Pakistan? Obviously, it's a different country. It's got a much stronger set of institutions, but the recent attacks over the weekend, particularly on the army headquarters in Rawalpindi, is going to refocus attention on the security issue there.
That was a huge, bold attack, which I think is really frightening if you're trying to assess the stability of Pakistan.
No, absolutely. In terms of a propaganda success, undoubtedly a huge coup for the militants. And the questions will be now, how does the army respond? To some extent, they got a bit of kudos back by rescuing most of the hostages that were in the headquarters. But the big question, including in Washington, I think, is in particular, in a broader sense, how you go about tackling the militants again in Pakistan, and particularly whether this much heralded offensive that the army has been talking about in North and South Waziristan, we've had the sort of preamble to it with air attacks and so on, whether that will now go ahead, and perhaps the attack on the army headquarters finally made the decision fairly easy for the army that it has to go ahead now.
So Marcus, we were talking earlier about how you can't separate Afghanistan and Pakistan, but the difference here is that in Afghanistan, we have permission from the United Nations to be there, to be, well, in most places in the country. In Pakistan, they don't necessarily want us there. They're our ally, but they don't want a large either U.S. or NATO presence there.
Well, we've had this problem with Pakistan for a while now. And the problem is you have an allied country where, at the same time, they are not fully cooperative, and even though they keep insisting they are fully cooperative in the hunt for terrorists, for instance. And they're not. And there's nothing you can do about that other than, you know, sort of invading a country that's a sovereign nation that does have, as Nick said, sovereign institutions and much more of a country than Afghanistan
nukes,
is.
Has nukes.
Yeah, right.
And this is why it's the most important and the most vexing problem in American foreign policy. There's no more important country, and one could argue no more dangerous country than Pakistan. It is the most destabilized, unstable nuclear power in the world. That said, you have to have a policy that attacks both Pakistan and Afghanistan together. We cannot change the government in Pakistan. We swore off that some decades ago here in Washington, changing foreign countries' governments, and the Bush administration did that in Iraq, and one could argue it wasn't that successful. However, we have to find something in between the two of them, between letting Pakistan be Pakistan and invading it and putting in a government that is going to be cooperative and strong.
Oh, definitely we can't get out of the agenda without talking about health care, because we do have the vote coming out of the Senate Finance Committee tomorrow. And there's been so much attention that people maybe are not used to on a committee as they put forward. Maybe people are confusing a committee vote with an actual vote of the Senate. How important actually is this vote coming out of the Senate Finance Committee?
So on Tuesday, there'll be a Senate Finance Committee vote on their proposed health care reform, the Baucus bill, as it's known. And it will obviously pass. It will probably pass most likely along party lines, as everything else has in this health care debate. It's important because this gives momentum back to this health care issue. You know, we actually haven't had many votes. We've had lots of kind of strum and drum and lots of heat and fire, not a lot of light on this debate. This will actually bring it back to the legislatures. And after the committee vote, then it will follow Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader's office, to reconcile that with another health committee vote in the Senate. And then it will at long last come to a Senate floor vote.
Did you say strum and drum?
I did.
As opposed to sturm and drang? I love that. Strum and drum. I like that.
That's the strum and drum is kind of folksy.
That's my French accent of German.
Marcus Mabee is the international business editor for our partner, the New York Times. And we're also joined by Nick Childs from our partner, the BBC. It looks like there's also going to be some economic things happening as well. We're going to have to keep an eye out for that.
There'll be a bunch of numbers this week. I will learn some things about consumer prices and some things about industrial production and whether or not we're actually recovering from our recession.
Okay. Thanks so much to Marcus and to Nick. That's the agenda for this week.
Hey, you want that to go?
Good morning, everyone. Some quick takeouts on stories we want you to stay on top of this week. We've got Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, in for Todd Zwillick this week. And also Louise Story is down there in Washington. Hello to you both, Julie and Louise.
Good morning.
Good morning. Let's begin with you, Julie. We were talking about health care a moment ago. Marcus Mabry of our partner, the New York Times, suggested that, in fact, there will be no Republican votes when there is finally a vote in the Senate Finance Committee, Max Baucus's Finance Committee, on that health care reform effort. What do you think?
Well, I think he was not taking a bold stand there. I think he was playing it safe with that prediction.
That's Marcus.
But, you know, they might get one. Yeah, you
who's
know,
the
I don't
one? Who's the one?
Persons on. He, there could be one. There could be Olympia Snow. You
could
know, they've
be
been
Olympia
working
Snow.
On her. But, you know, you never know. She could go either way. So, it could come down to a party line vote, as Marcus predicted.
Now, there's been lots of criticism of this bill, particularly on the left, and certainly plenty of it on the right. And the lack of a Republican vote is an indication that there is criticism. But it does, it looks to me mathematically that it cuts the number of uninsured in the United States, in theory at least, by half, down to 17 million. Is that a headline that the Obama administration should be touting? Or, you know, why is there the negative sniping?
Well, there's always negative sniping in Washington. That's just the nature of the beast. The thing is, you know, the White House, you don't really hear them talking about bipartisanship anymore. And they just want to get this done. And whatever's in the bill now may not be in the bill a month from now. So the details of the bill really aren't that important at this point. The way it looks now is not going to be how it ends up. And there's five different bills. They all have to be reconciled. So this is just, you know, another drop in the bucket for health care reform.
Is there a next issue up in the fight between both houses of Congress? The House has a very different view than the Senate. Anything to look forward to?
Well, yeah, they're probably going to get rid of the idea of co-ops, which had its day
really?
And now seems to be fading. Yeah, of course, co-ops came in to replace the public option. And now one of the things they're looking at is a sort of national health care plan that states could opt in and out of. That's sort of the surging issue. But, you know, something else, some fourth idea could come along and take the place of that, too, so that they're really still grappling with the whole issue of a low-cost alternative to private insurance. And they haven't come up with the answer yet.
Well, definitely pay attention to that. Co-ops on the way out. That's the next battle up. On the healthcare debate, Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Thanks, Julie.
Let's go to Louise Story now, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. So this is an interesting concept that we're hearing. It's been a year since the government bailed out the financial industry. The financial industry is now recording profits. They're giving big bonuses to their employees again. And now there's these little rumors going around Capitol Hill that maybe we can scrape off some of those profits that the financial industry is taking and pay for health care. How does this work?
It sounds crazy, right?
Right.
Good morning. It sounds crazy, but when you look at how this idea evolved, it doesn't sound so crazy. So first, about a year ago, there was a provision put in the bailout that said we've got to tax financial transactions on these banks to repay any bailout money that was lost.
Right.
So that's how the idea started. Then, you know, the way ideas change is, you know, they change in small increments until they become wildly different. And so then it became, well, let's tax banks for the new cost of regulation. Now some people have started saying, well, let's have the banks help pay for the stimulus. You know, they could build some bridges or schools. And some people are even saying, how about using money from banks to help pay for health care? So at this point, you know, Wall Street's not very popular. I don't know if you feel sorry for Wall Street. Most people don't feel sorry for Wall Street. So they're not going to have a very strong argument on the Hill telling lawmakers they shouldn't tax them.
Meaning that nobody wants to stand up and defend Goldman.
Oh, who can defend Wall Street? I mean, what happened to your 401k last year, right? It got totally slaughtered. And so taxing Wall Street's not going to be unpopular. The strongest argument against it's going to be that people might take their business abroad. So some Republicans are saying, whoa, be careful. We don't want people to take their financial transactions abroad. And a tax, you know, maybe could do that.
So this plan originally came out of some unions like the AFL-CIO and the Economic Policy Institute. Are people treating this like some harebrained scheme coming from the far left?
Well, it is more the far left that's saying we should use money from the banks for these alternative things, such as stimulus spending or health care. But again, the idea of taxing Wall Street more started right in the mainstream a year ago with the bailout. It's just that when that idea started, it was the money would be used only to pay for regulation or to make up the cost of the bailout. So
yes or no, Louise, could this happen?
It could happen.
Okay.
Do you feel sorry for Wall Street?
It could happen.
Finance could reporter happen. For our partners, the New York Times. Thanks, Louise.
Well, it did happen yesterday in the baseball playoffs. It's time to talk sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen with our sports takeout. So who's in and who's out in the baseball playoffs at this point?
So right now in the AL, you have the Yankees are in, the Angels are in, the Dodgers are in, and we're still waiting on the Phillies.
And sweeps in the American League. I mean, it was such a heartbreaker for the Boston Red Sox fans. Listen to this.
They're loaded for the Angels with two outs. Guerrero swings and lines it into center field. It's in for a hit. From third base comes Figgins to tie the score. Here comes Abreu, and the Angels will take the lead. With two outs in the ninth inning, they have scored three times to take the lead.
The Angels sweep the Red Sox, and in the bottom of the ninth, what happened?
Jonathan Papelbon gave up runs, and he actually... Red Sox fans in Fenway Park had never, ever seen that before. It was heartbreaking.
One of the most reliable closers in baseball and absolutely nailed. Now, does this mean the Angels are favored steaming into New York to play the Yankees?
The Angels have one of the best stories with the passing of Nick Adenhart early in the season, their pitcher. They really gathered around each other and came together. They have an aggressive approach at every bat. They have an intimidating lineup with Bobby Abreu and Torrey Hunter and Vlad Guerrero. And it's such a potent lineup, and they're clutch. They're very much like the New York Yankees.
All right. Yankees will be playing the California Angels. What about the other L.A. team, the Dodgers?
The Dodgers, actually, they got up early against St. Louis, and they just crushed them. They totally just, you know, they made it look easy almost in a very strange way. The Highway Series, which I'm calling, the Highway Series, which might be L.A. versus L.A., is coming up, could potentially happen after now.
And Philadelphia is delayed because of that weather problem in Denver over the weekend, but the Philadelphia leads Colorado 2-1 in that series, and we'll see if the Rockies or the Phillies emerge there. Finally, college football. Can you tell me anything about my Ducks?
The Ducks actually did extremely well this weekend. They played, they beat UCLA quite, yeah, they're doing great.
So the Oregon Ducks in the Pac-10 look like the power there by beating UCLA. Finally, give us, you know more about college football than I do. All I do is follow the Ducks.
So there's teams that control their own destiny in the hunt for the national title. The SEC has three teams that are in that situation, but mainly it's Florida and Alabama. They're extremely good. There's also Texas and USC. They look good. But the key thing to remember about college football this time of the year is that right now the players are taking their first exams, their first papers are being handed in. In other words, as the hunt for the title heats up, so does everything else in the lives of these players and the student athletes. So as important as the rankings go, it's equally important as their GPA. The balancing act is in full gear.
Wow, that's interesting. Top performer so far in the college game?
Florida. That's what it's all about.
Right. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. There's your takeout. Coming up, the latest on a new series of attacks by militants in Pakistan. The BBC will be there. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. One more glass ceiling is shattered this morning. American Eleanor Ostrom is the first woman to win the Nobel Prize for Economics. She's sharing the prize with another American. Tomorrow, the Senate Finance Committee is set to vote on its health care plan, but there's still a long way to go for an overhaul. A fight in the full Senate looms, and the House has several very different bills.
In California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is calling a special session of lawmakers focusing on the state's water problems. 12 hours of talks ended without any agreement over the weekend. The question is how to pay for much-needed upgrades in the water system. Our partner, the New York Times, has a page one story on illegal immigration this morning. The Times reports the U.S. still has no reliable system for verifying that foreign visitors have left the country after their legal visas expire. North Korea has apparently test-fired 5 short-range missiles off its east coast. A South Korean news agency has that story. And moving to Afghanistan, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the winner of the country's presidential election there will need to build a new relationship with the Afghan people and the U.S. That's in an interview with our partner, the BBC. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
So over the weekend, two very bold attacks in Pakistan. The Taliban officially taking responsibility for one. And this morning we're dealing with 41 people dead after an explosion near the troubled Swat Valley. Earlier we were joined by Aleem Maqbool from our partner, the BBC. He joined us from Islamabad, Pakistan, to talk about the top international story, which the details of which are still emerging. I began the conversation by asking him what he knows so far about the nature of the attack this morning near the Swat Valley.
this is an area, I mean, it's a very picturesque sort of resort area. It used to be very popular with Western tourists, but over the last few years, it's been beset with problems with militancy. And what we hear is that a car filled with explosives drove into a military convoy, a convoy of the Pakistan Army, and at least 40 people have been killed. Now, it actually hit the convoy in an area where there's a market and where there's a hospital as well. So while some of the dead are troops, a lot of the dead are civilians as well.
Now, you also had this attack in Rawalpindi where Taliban fighters launched a bold attack, holding really military soldiers hostage. The army was able to get the hostages released, but it seems a line in the sand has been set down. This is revenge for the death of Batula Masood, and that if the Pakistan army attempts a new assault against the Taliban, it will be its undoing.
Yes, you might well be right. That attack in Rawalpindi was extraordinary in terms of its audacity, its sophistication. This was an attack on the main headquarters of Pakistan's army, what's supposed to be one of the most heavily secured compounds in the country. And yet militants not only attacked the front gate, a second group of militants seems to have got inside and held hostages within the heart of the main compound of the army. The siege was broken when commandos raided the building, and the Pakistani army is claiming it as a success, that rescue operation. A lot of the hostages were released, were freed, although three were killed. But a lot of Pakistanis are looking at the fact that the militants got in there in the first
Indeed.
Place. And if there is going to be this big offensive in the tribal areas, then a lot of Pakistanis are saying, well, who's going to protect us in the cities when the militants hit back?
And it's a very important question, not just for Pakistani civilians. Aleem Maqbool of our partner, the BBC, joining us from Islamabad, Pakistan. Thank you so much. So listen to what Hillary Clinton said over the weekend.
The extremists in Pakistan, whatever their title or whatever their affiliation, are increasingly threatening the authority of the state. But we see no evidence that they are going to take over the state.
No evidence? The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, says there is no evidence that the Taliban is either capable of or is intending to take over the state. Joining us now is Marvin Weinbaum, a scholar at the Middle East Institute, former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Good morning, Marvin.
Good morning.
Can the Secretary of State make that claim? No evidence?
Well, I think what she's saying, we know that that's their ultimate intention. But what she's saying here is that certainly nothing is imminent as far as their ability to establish themselves in Islamabad, to take on and, if not defeat the army, then get the army to back off. So I think she's essentially correct, but I think that we should have no doubt about where they would like to be, especially under this new leadership of Hakimullah Masood.
Well, Marvin Weinbaum, a couple of senators and lawmakers over the weekend here in Washington raised the issue of nukes in Pakistan. How do we assess, as Americans, whether the nuclear weapons in Pakistan are safe as Pakistan grapples with this instability in dealing with the Taliban?
Well, the reason that we have expressed our own satisfaction that they're not in jeopardy is we've had a role in helping them set up their command and control system. We know what it's like. And as long as the military remains intact, we feel pretty confident that they'll be able to protect those nukes. I think what we need to be concerned about is that not only have the Taliban demonstrated the ability to penetrate areas thought to be safe, but to be concerned that there might be assistance from the inside. In fact, that may have very well occurred in the Rawalpindi event.
So, Marvin Weinbaum, former State Department analyst on these two areas, we were talking just a moment ago about how the Taliban is claiming these attacks are retaliation for the killing of Batula Masood, but that it seems to me that there's a lot of attacks. I mean, they seem to be using that as an excuse for a lot of these attacks. Is this the lead up to a larger offensive in terms of taking over as many regions in Pakistan as they possibly can?
Well, I think we really had concern about that a few months ago when they moved out of Swat into two adjoining districts. There's not much likelihood of that right now. You see, these attacks, at least as I see them, they demonstrate the ability of the Taliban to take action just about anywhere in the country. And that That is frightening.
It is frightening.
But,
yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that they are across-the-board threat. After all, these attacks don't require anything but a car of explosives and someone willing to kill himself.
Well, then, let's on the sort of interior level, what capacity does the Taliban have to turn members of the armed forces, to maybe bring them aboard and create alliances inside the military?
Well, what the army does is it has a fairly rigorous means of trying to sort out those kinds of people. They don't mind people being religiously oriented. In fact, many of the people in the junior ranks are. But they want their loyalty to be to the military first.
Well, fairly rigorous means to sort out who's loyal and who isn't. That's a good takeaway this morning. Marvin Weinbaum, scholar at the Middle East Institute and the former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan, trying to assess the stability of Pakistan this morning after two very bold attacks over the weekend and one just this morning in which more than 40 people died. So if you're thinking about mom and dad's home or grandma and grandpa's home and that fabulous chair that you've always wanted, if something should happen to them when they go into the hereafter.
Probably your sister wants also.
It turns out you don't need $180 million to fight over to have huge problems at inheritance time. Coming up, our family segment is all about that.
Yeah, you can fight over a spatula.
With a spatula, even. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. You know, you think that winning the Nobel Peace Prize and with its prize money of $1.4 million tax-free dollars,
wow,
you'd think that would be pretty much
all day.
Good.
Make
like,
your day.
There's no downside to
sure,
that, right?
Yeah.
Well, but for President Obama, there kind of was a downside. Here's some voices from over the weekend.
If he can successfully turn around Afghanistan, deter Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, I will build a bookcase for him to put it in.
When you are adored by European capitals, that is never good for a president.
So this is an anti-American committee.
I think what he ought to do, frankly, is send the mother of a fallen American soldier.
It's early. It's premature.
That's pretty amazing.
Very cool.
Won the Nobel
Very
Peace cool. Prize. Ironically, his biggest accomplishment as president so far? Winning the Nobel Peace Prize.
So President Obama probably wants to talk about things like health care, maybe, and instead of worrying about whether or not he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize. Joining us now is Delaina Dixon. She's a TV blogger at DelainaDixon.com. Good morning, Delaina.
Good morning, guys.
So this was all the talk, not just on television, but on the Internet as well. This was everyone's favorite topic of conversation.
Oh, absolutely. You think about all those late-night talk show hosts. I mean, they really haven't had anything juicy to kind of make fun of the president for. So this was their opportunity to be topical, especially in the political arena. It's something that they've loved to do. So it was the first time they could really jump on it and make some jokes and a little bit of light fodder of the whole situation.
Does just being talked about on all these shows and being the subject of a Leno monologue, does that actually boost his ratings?
You know, it always reaches mass media when you're talked about on the late night talk shows and all over the internet and every political pundit talking about you. Obviously, it would be great if the subject matter was something a little bit more substantial, like you said, healthcare. But if it's getting people talking about our president, then it can't be that bad of a thing.
Well, it was all over the blogs and all over Facebook and all over Twitter as well. Here's some reaction from some of our listeners.
Jay Foley from Boston, Massachusetts, and I'm very surprised to see that Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize. I support the president, but I don't think there's been a lot of performance there. My concern is that it kind of waters down the Nobel Peace Prize a little bit, I think. Feels sort of political.
Things were relatively evenly split. This ended up to be a discussion that was not split on party lines. You've got John McCain saying this is an honor for the United States. You, of course, heard Lindsey Graham earlier talking about if President Obama can turn around Afghanistan, he'll build a bookcase for President Obama to put his award into. This ended up not being a kind of argument between Republicans and Democrats. Did that surprise you?
No, actually, I think John McCain gets it. You know, obviously, our president is being recognized for trying to bring international humanitarian efforts to the world. And isn't that something that we should actually be excited about? So it's really interesting that people are saying, oh, this is a horrible thing. It's a joke. He's being recognized for an action that can happen over the next 4 years.
Well, Delaina, I think everyone should make a bookshelf for the president, like Lindsey Graham was saying. We should all make bookshelves for the president.
To celebrate.
I don't think he's going
to
want my bookshelf. I'm the worst handyman ever.
Such a weird remark for Lindsey Graham to make.
Maybe he's a really good carpenter, John.
Who knows?
Maybe you're underestimating his bookshelf-building abilities.
It's an authentic Graham bookcase made...
That's right.
In the early part of the 20th century, 21st century.
If you spend any time on the internet, you can check out a lot of this stuff that we've been talking about. Delaina Dixon is a TV blogger at DelainaDixon.com. Thanks, Delaina.
Good morning. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, so you don't need to be an Astor to come to blows over a family inheritance. Money can be thicker than blood. We have two guests to talk about it in just a moment. Some great stories also. And President Obama has a few months to prepare his speech to accept his Nobel Peace Prize. He's gotten all kinds of accolades. He's gotten some criticism. But we want to enlist you as speechwriter assistants for the president at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakethetakeaway.org. We've already gotten some great suggestions. Lou emails, I would like to thank President Bush for making this possible, is what Obama should say. Or Jade emails, aw, you shouldn't have. Suggestions for that speech in Oslo for the president, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. In Pakistan, a suicide car bomb attacked a military convoy in the country's northwest. At least 41 people are dead. Pakistan's military has new information on a separate attack on its army headquarters on Saturday in Rawalpindi. The military says the intent was to take top officers hostage and use them as bargaining chips. The Taliban has claimed responsibility.
Back in the U.S., the Senate Finance Committee is set to vote on its health care plan tomorrow. And four decades after it happened, a man wanted for hijacking an airplane is now under arrest. He's accused of diverting a 1968 flight out of New York to Cuba. That's before I was born. He's been living in Cuba ever since. Looking ahead, the Philadelphia Phillies and
college. So you weren't on the plane.
I was not on the plane. Okay, maybe with the thought of
me. Right.
And Colorado Rockies
play
game four of their playoff series today. The Phillies lead 2-1. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Good morning. Our Monday family segment today starts off with a little story.
Please, two brothers were in my office fighting over Dad's football trophy and a Howdy Doody lunchbox.
That's Les Kotzer. He's a wills attorney with a focus on avoiding family fights over inheritances. He's the author of The Family Fight and Where There's an Inheritance, and his story continues.
And I took one aside in my office to try to bring some common sense to this. And as I was talking to this brother, off my desk came a massive law book thrown at his brother's head. The brother had violently took that book off my desk and tried to injure his brother.
To Lee Kotzer, more stories of inheritance problems, stories that are even more amazing than what happened last week when the jury came to a verdict in the Brooke Astor trial. Her son, Anthony Marshall, found guilty of stealing $1 million from the ailing New York philanthropist. He was sentenced to 25 years in jail. Eve Rachel Markovich joins us, a litigator who focuses on estate issues at families who aren't of the stature of the Astors. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning.
And Lisa Belkin writes the family and parenting blog Motherload for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
So how much of an electric third rail issue is this for families, the notion of what we're going to get from grandma and grandpa or mom and dad when they finally leave this world?
Well, we fight over everything else with our siblings. Why wouldn't we fight over that? I mean, the relationship starts so early and it's so competitive. And then we think that suddenly it's going to change because we're now the grown-ups when our parents die. And it doesn't always work that way. I think if you have gotten along well with your siblings through your parents' life, you will get along well with them after your parents are gone. But if not, then not so much.
Whether there's $180 million at stake, as there was in the Astor estate, or just a lamp or a Ford Mustang, it brings out the worst in people, Eve Rachel Markovich?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have a case right now where the surviving children from a first marriage have actually gone to court to try to set aside their deceased father's marriage to my client simply for the purpose of depriving her of a trust which he set up for her.
And again, that's an amount of money, roughly how much?
The trust is, you know, well, it's a bit more than thousands, but they have spent over $2 million for a trust amount, which is not significant enough to merit it.
Okay, so it's a chunk of money that we wouldn't sneeze at, Celeste, right?
Yeah.
But listen to this fight, and this is Les Kotzer again telling the story about something that we would definitely sneeze at.
I was coming back from lunch with my partner one day, and I see this woman waiting for us in our parking lot, and she's waving this crystal figurine. She says, I bought this from my mother. I want it back. My sister says, who's the executor, says, I cannot have it. I said, ma'am, we are handling your mother's estate. You'll get your money from everything. She says, no, I want this crystal figurine. And my sister says, I can't have it. She said, if I can't have it, then nobody's going to have it. And she took it and smashed it in front of my partner and myself in our parking lot.
So, Eve, Rachel Markowitz, how do you advise people not to do things like this?
Well, there's a practical way, which is talk to your kids. I'm a firm believer in telling people what they can expect before you die, and it helps an enormous amount because, as Lisa said, this is all about family relationships. It's the same person that you fought with over who was going to get the front seat, and if you know what's going on beforehand, you're less likely to start a fight. The other issue is there's a legal provision called an interorum clause or a no contest clause. And if you're actually leaving something to someone in a will and you want to make sure that that person isn't going to fight the will to get more, you say, look, if you start a fight, you don't get anything. And that's actually pretty persuasive.
So, Lisa, I have to ask you, I actually had a friend whose grandmother passed away recently. And my friend, who is probably the most soft-spoken, easygoing woman in the world, called me up anguished because she said she had no idea she would care about where her grandmother's Shakespeare collection went. And suddenly she found herself getting in huge, massive screaming fights with her siblings about the smallest things. And she couldn't believe she cared about this stuff. Does this happen to a lot of people?
I think it does. I think that when families get back together, everyone becomes 15 again. I mean, they sort of get locked back into where they were in adolescence, and they find themselves acting in ways that are familiar because they used to do it, but don't make any sense because they're now adults. I think there is so much layered on top of the death of a family member that it brings out surprising things. And the only real solution, and it does not always work, is to talk about it in advance. And some people are comfortable with that, and that's a conversation some people just won't have.
So, Lisa Belkin, of course, your takeaway contributor, you write the Motherlode blog. I guess this raises a bigger issue, and that is the courts are not appropriate places to resolve this. It's better around the kitchen table or the dining room table before mom and dad pass on into the hereafter, Lisa?
Yes, but of course you have to be discussing much more than just stuff. You know, you're saying, well, everybody get along now, and if everyone hasn't gotten along, they're not going to get along after this. I mean, sometimes transformations take place. I've noticed in my own family, when there's a death in the family, people have joined together in camaraderie in a way that maybe didn't happen when everyone was alive. But
Kumbaya,
it doesn't
really
last forever.
It doesn't last. Well, Eve, what's the best story you've ever heard of people who behaved responsibly, who took the appropriate steps and averted what could have been a catastrophe over the figurine or the $180 million?
Well, the best story is the story that never gets to the litigator.
Right.
Sorry about being so obvious about it, but
we love obvious.
It's interesting that Lisa, coming from a non-legal perspective, and me coming from a perspective where, you know, I actually make a living when we have these fights, we're both saying the same thing. Talk to people. And someone asked me the other day, well, as a child, should I sit down and ask my parents what they're planning to do with their wills? Well, the simple answer to that is probably not, because your parents might think that you're willing, you know, getting ready to kill them off. But from the parents' perspective, it is absolutely the best thing that you can do. And don't present it as, you know, this is a choice, we want to get your input. But just, look, this is what we've decided to do, and we want you to be able to talk to us about it while we're still here.
Good advice, and it just goes to show you what's a problem for the Astor family can also be a problem for the Gillespies, the Smiths, the Joneses, everybody else. Eve, Rachel Markowitz, a litigator who focuses on real estate issues and estate issues, a partner at Markowitz and Rosenstock, and Lisa Belkin, takeaway contributor and writer of the parenting blog Motherlode. And we'll leave you with another heartwarming story from our friend Les Kotzer.
Well, I had a woman contact me, and she talked to me about her dad's Mustang convertible. Her father had made a will leaving everything equal to the three children. She didn't want the car. Her two brothers wanted the car. And she said, okay, we're going to have a family auction. So she said, one day, my brother bid a certain number. The next day, my other brother bid a dollar higher. They kept bidding like that just to bother the other one. And she said, I ended up having to sell the car to a stranger. She said, my brothers now hate each other.
Lucky Mustang owner probably got a good price, too.
I'm sure it did. If you have your own story to share about an inheritance gone wrong, you can tell us at 8778-MYTAKE or by email at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. We're also taking your advice for President Obama. If you were writing his acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize, you have a few months to do it, but we're asking you to let us know today. What should he say? 8778-MYTAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
Thanks. Thanks for the prize.
That's it. That's all you'd say.
Thank you. Thank you, Norwegians.
Thank you, Norwegian committee. Somehow I think he'll probably wax a little more eloquent than
probably,
that, John.
He probably should do that.
If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go at thetakeaway.org. You can subscribe there.
Actually, you should just call up and say thank you to the Norwegian committee on 8778-MYTAKE. All right, enough from me. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is The Takeaway.
Looking for Mr. Right in Afghanistan. Do we have an enemy yet?
I'll give you one more chance.
Trying to distinguish between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Well, they are different, but they are interconnected.
Choosing an enemy, it's between the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. But for the Obama administration and the Taliban, we could be witnessing the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Coming this fall.
Sleeping with the Enemy.
It's only a movie on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 12th. Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, Al-Qaeda. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. You know, you probably heard the old cliche that lawmaking is a lot like sausage making. Doesn't matter how you feel about the final product, but the process of making them will probably make you sick. Well, we're going to go through the process of making laws when we get an update on the health care bill. And we're also going to see about making NFL football plays with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
But first, Megan O'Sullivan, professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and former deputy national security advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan in the George W. Bush administration. Megan, if the Obama administration aggressively engages with the Taliban, we've got some hints now, would that represent a complete reversal of the Bush administration policy?
The Bush administration recognized the importance of reconciliation in a long-term solution. In fact, it supported a government of Afghanistan program to reintegrate low-level Taliban in 2004 and 2005. But the main difference is the Bush administration did not think that true reconciliation was possible when it was done from a position of weakness like we are in today.
Well, we'll talk more about that and the difficulties and challenges of finding those low-level Taliban. Megan O'Sullivan, stay with us. We'll be back to you in just a moment. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, I think this is worth a you go, girl. For the first time ever, the Nobel Prize for Economics goes to a woman, American Eleanor Ostrom. She shares the prize with another American. Overseas, North Korea has test-fired 5 short-range missiles off its east coast. That story comes from a South Korean news agency.
Staying abroad, in Pakistan, 41 are dead after an attack on a military convoy in the northwest. It's the most recent in a series of attacks in Pakistan. This says Pakistan's military has new information on a separate attack on its army headquarters Saturday. The military says the attacker's goal was to take top officers hostage and use them as bargaining chips to win the release of militant leaders. The Taliban took responsibility for that attack. And back in the U.S., the Senate Finance Committee is finally expected to vote tomorrow on its health care bill overhaul, reform, whatever.
Our partner, The New York Times, has a page one story on immigration this morning. The Times reports the U.S. still has no reliable system for verifying that foreign visitors have left the country after their visas expire.
So Wall Street gained a bit on Friday. The Dow will open on this Columbus Day at 98.65, and S&P starts trading at 10.71. The Nasdaq begins at 21.39. And according to futures trading, the rally is expected to continue. President Obama has got a few months to prepare his speech to accept his Nobel Peace Prize. There's been a lot of cynicism out of Washington, but a lot of good feelings on the part of some of our listeners. We want to actually extend your offer to give the president some advice. What should he put in his speech? Call us at 8778-MYTAKE. Actually, give the speech. Or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Your suggestions for Obama accepting the Nobel Peace Prize.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
So you can almost hear the challenge, the difficulty that the administration, really so many on Capitol Hill and in Washington, are having trying to distinguish the really bad guys in Afghanistan from the just bad guys who may end up being something of an ally on the battlefield in Afghanistan.
Who are distinguished from the bad guys who are still our allies, and we need them in order to win any kind of war in
Afghanistan.
Right,
that would be the Pakistanis you're talking about there. Okay, well, listen to Senator Mitch McConnell. We made some sport of the Republican senator talking on Face the Nation, but here's the quote in context.
You do get the impression the administration is, at least some in the administration, are trying to distinguish between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Well, they are different, but they are interconnected. We know that when the Taliban was in charge in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda was allowed to operate freely. We know they launched the 9/11 attack from there, planned it and launched it from there.
As if to directly answer the Republican senator speaking over the weekend, Hillary Clinton, in an interview broadcast this morning on the BBC, an interview conducted yesterday, couldn't have sounded more clear.
We are not changing our strategy. Our strategy remains to achieve the goal of disrupting, dismantling, and defeating Al-Qaeda and its extremist allies.
No mention of the Taliban there.
Not everyone who calls himself a Taliban is necessarily a threat to the UK or to the United States.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking in a BBC interview broadcast this morning. Megan O'Sullivan rejoins us now, professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, former deputy national security advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan in the George W. Bush administration. Is the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton correct there? Not everyone who calls himself a Taliban is necessarily a threat to the UK or the United States?
I think she's right in suggesting that the Taliban is a very heterogeneous group, and that there are different elements of the Taliban, and that, again, over the long term, it is possible and even essential to bring elements or different constituencies of the Taliban into the political process. But I think to put the emphasis or make that the primary focus of the strategy right now is very, very premature.
Why is it premature? And you spoke a moment ago at the top of the hour that we are operating from a position of weakness. Explain.
Well, I think as most people are in agreement about, that the last year in Afghanistan has represented some serious setbacks for the coalition and for the Afghan government in the face of a resurgent Taliban insurgency. Now, what I'm saying about why it's premature is that we have to distinguish between reconciliation that results, it's a natural evolution from successful combat operations, and between reconciliation that is done in place of successful combat operations. And certainly the message that is given by even the initiation of reconciliation, when it's perceived to be done because the coalition is unable to win military victories against the Taliban, that has a very different prospect for success in the medium and long term than if it would, say, in Iraq, when the adversary is under enormous pressure and has an incentive to compromise.
Right.
Those circumstances don't exist in Afghanistan at the moment.
Megan O'Sullivan is professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And just down the road in Cambridge, Fatini Christie is professor of political science at MIT and comes back to the takeaway. Last time we spoke to you, Fatini, you were saying that, in a sense, the notion of reconciliation or some kind of natural engagement with the Taliban is a policy that hasn't even been tried. Do you still believe that?
Absolutely. There have been some overtures, and there are people on the ground that are informally trying to talk to different commanders on the ground. But the attempts so far have been on the kind of high level in Saudi Arabia, which have led to nothing because these are the elements that are largely irreconcilable, or very kind of low level discussions with some fighters that are, of course, not going to lead to anything substantial either.
Do you think or do you agree with Megan O'Sullivan over at the Kennedy School and who's on the line here that there is some sort of natural kind of way of creating a reconciliation with the Taliban that's going to bring the people who would naturally be allied with the coalition forward?
There's certainly a big number of Taliban constituents who would be keen on reconciling. The issue has to be that the circumstances have to be right. I would definitely agree with Megan that we need to squeeze them first. They are in a position of strength right now, and this was clear also by the message that Mullah Omar gave at the end of Ramadan, when he was basically saying, you know, I'm keen on being part of a political process, but he insinuated that he would be kind of leading it. So before we get them to reconcile, we'd have to have some to make some headway on the ground militarily, and we're not there yet.
So, Megan, we heard just now Hillary Clinton talking about the fact that not all Taliban are a threat, and we also heard reports last week that President Obama is open to maybe including some members of the Taliban in the Afghani government. Is this kind of a prelude to maybe getting some of these less radical members of the Taliban to end the fighting?
I think we need to distinguish here between reconciliation with different types of Taliban. There's reconciliation that we actually heard Karzai, President Karzai, talk about a lot in the context of the election campaign, and that would be reconciliation with high-level leadership type. And there, I don't think that there's any prospect for a meaningful reconciliation. But other elements of the Taliban, a second category, which might be called sort of ordinary Afghans who support or engage in the insurgency for much more less ideological reasons, there's a possibility to bring those people in. But as Fantini suggested, that bringing those people in at this juncture, one, they don't have any incentive to stand against the Taliban in favor of the Afghan state right now.
All right,
and two, bring those people in isn't going to bring about a strategic shift at this moment.
Well, let's talk about the mechanism for squeezing them first in a moment. Megan O'Sullivan, a professor at the Kennedy School of Government, a former deputy national security advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan. It sounded like what you were saying a moment ago, Megan O'Sullivan, that throwing in with Hamid Karzai was a huge mistake of the Bush administration.
I'm not sure where you got the impression that I was saying that. I was simply saying that we actually did support President Karzai and the Afghan government in 2004 and 2005 when it implemented a strategy to reconcile with low-level Taliban. It was a program that had all kinds of difficulties with it in terms of monitoring people after they've left the Taliban and supposedly reintegrated into society. But it did reconcile, I'd say, at least 2,000 low-level Taliban. That wasn't a mistake because, again, 2004 in 2005, we and the Afghan government were doing that from a position of strength and not from a position of weakness.
Okay. Let me just get it clear. Is the Karzai government too weak to have any engagement with the Taliban at this point and therefore should be discounted?
I would say that the Karzai government, the prospects for engaging the Taliban at the very, very senior level in terms of bringing in the leadership of the Taliban into the political process, I don't see that bearing fruit in any way.
Wow.
Part because of the current strength or lack thereof of the Afghan government, but also in part because those people have no incentive to make political compromises when they think that they may be on the verge of an epic military win in Afghanistan. The ability to say that they defeated the West, there's no incentive for them to compromise with President Karzai.
Okay, that's clear. So, Fatini Christie, I don't want to put words in Megan O'Sullivan's mouth, but do you think there's a point down the road, and you can see it as a political science professor at MIT, where we write off the Karzai government?
All I'm going to say is that we can't make any decisions as to how to move forward before the issue of the electoral fraud and where we stand gets resolved some way or another. Within this week, we'll know if there's going to be a second round or not. And the president can't really make any decisions before that's resolved because any counterinsurgency strategy relies on the assumption that you have a government in place that's working on your side. And right now, there's a complete void. So I don't think Karzai will be written off in any time soon because even if we have a second round, he's the one who will most likely get elected. But there are huge legitimacy issues.
Right.
And issues of accountability.
Okay, then before we go in this segment, it seems that you both agree that the Taliban need to be squeezed before there are any serious negotiations with them. I would suspect that squeezing the Taliban would mean that both of you agree more troops need to go into Afghanistan. Megan O'Sullivan?
I would definitely support General McChrystal's recommendation that requires, it's a focus on counterinsurgency strategy that requires more troops. For one of the primary purposes is squeezing the Taliban to allow for the emergence and building of an effective Afghan state.
All right. To Megan O'Sullivan, professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, former deputy national security advisor in the George W. Bush administration. Fatini Christie, I'll give you the last word. Does squeezing the Taliban mean give McChrystal everything he wants in Afghanistan?
The question is whether this is a binary choice, whether we go counterinsurgency or counterterrorism, or whether there is some sort of continuous spectrum and there is kind of a middle ground. There's a lot of discussion that the president may try a middle option where he agrees to some troop increase but doesn't go all the way to the 40,000. Whether that's going to be an incrementalist strategy that works or not, we'll just have to see.
All right. Fotini Christie, a professor of political science at MIT. There's a very interesting discussion of what to do with the Taliban and who's our enemy over there. Thanks to both of you.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some quick takeouts on stories we want you to be on top of this week. And this morning, let's be on top of the NFL. Week six, is it now? Yeah. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is here. You know, it seems like the top story for all the football over the weekend was the Broncos and Bengals. Are they for real? Cincinnati Bengals, Denver Broncos.
Well, the Broncos beat the Patriots yesterday 20-17. It was a thrilling overtime game. And I think the takeaway from that is a couple things. First of all, New England fans, it was a difficult day yesterday.
Yeah, it was tough with the Red Sox going down as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and then Tom Brady's costly sack and fumble in the last 2 minutes showed that there are problems with the New England offensive line, and the aura of Tom Brady's invincibility is slowly dissipating. Basically, he was never the same since after getting beaten by Plaxico Burress and company in the Super Bowl
right.
2 years ago.
So that's what we're seeing here.
Exactly.
And nobody picked the Broncos.
You're right. Nobody did pick the Broncos. And they had so much offseason turmoil.
Well, listen to this.
Cardiac cats.
He seems to think that the Cincinnati Bengals are for real.
I think they are. The team that founder Paul Brown built are now 4-1. They're in a very tough division, the AFC North, which includes the Ravens,
Beat the Ravens yesterday.
They beat the Ravens yesterday 17-14. They're now 3-0 in the division. They're 3-0 on the road. And check this out. Hamilton County, where Cincinnati's at, has a 9.6 unemployment rate. That's just above the national average. And with the unemployment in Ohio and with the Browns in Ohio, at least you have the Cincinnati Bengals.
Okay, they're the one good headline in the state of Ohio. Also, we should point out the Vikings are also 5-0 at this point.
Correct.
All right, because they beat the Rams and the New York Giants
are
unbeaten at this point.
And Indianapolis as well.
All right, so big news for American soccer quickly before we go.
Well, the American soccer team qualified for the World Cup by beating Honduras 3-2. Woo-hoo. The other two countries in the similar places are Mexico and Trinidad and Tobago. So in their division or their area, the Caribbean, Central America, and North America, that is how the United States is going to go to South Africa next year and hopefully represent
huge
well.
Huge story. All right, we should remind you the Jets play the Dolphins tonight on Monday Night Football. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much.
Hey, good morning.
Let's go to Capitol Hill next. Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is out this week, so we've got Julie Mason. She's the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. So, Julie, we were talking earlier about how everyone was talking about President Obama's Nobel Peace Prize win last week, and some Republicans were pretty ticked off about it. We're going to listen to Rush Limbaugh here.
He's basically emasculating this country, and they applauded today with this award. They love a weakened, neutered United States.
So who are the...
Neutered?
I like how he put in his
fighting words.
Clapping special effects there. So who were the Republicans that were the most outraged by him winning this prize?
Well, the ones who were the most outraged were the ones who were the most obscure. We heard from some, you know, state attorneys general who were extremely exercised about this. But now we've heard from, you know, Liz Cheney has been sounding off, and the Republican National Committee is now using Obama's Nobel Prize as a fundraising tool, asking patriotic Americans to ante up against these Democrats' international leftist allies. So it's just everybody's piling on now.
What's most interesting is that there was not a unified front coming out of the Republican Party. Listen to John McCain.
The Nobel Committee, I can't divine all their intentions, but I think part of their decision-making was expectations, and I'm sure the president understands that he now has even more to live up to. But as Americans, we're proud when our president receives an award of that prestigious category.
I would imagine that on Capitol Hill, at least, John McCain's words weigh a bit more than Rush Limbaugh's.
A little bit. You know, and anyone who is thinking of running for president or has run for president took a very low-key line on this. They don't want to be out front. It's really sort of the D-listers who are getting all hot and bothered about it. So, yeah, the Republicans of more stature are sort
Julie,
of standing down.
Julie, you have to, like, call those D-listers up and get interviews with them. What are you doing?
What am I doing with my time, John? I don't know.
No, you called me a D-lister on the takeaway, Julie. Click.
There goes her Rolodex.
Well.
Okay, Julie Mason is the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you.
Well, we got a lot of response throughout the weekend. That happened on Friday. It was sort of a late Friday story. Barack Obama wins the Nobel Peace Prize. It was early morning on Friday, but it lasted through the weekend. We asked for responses from you. We got lots and lots. But first of all, we want more. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give Obama some advice on his speech that he's got to write for accepting the award, which
he says
he's going
to
do.
The Academy.
Exactly. My take at thetakeaway.org. But we wanted to give some serious reactions about news of President Obama. His Nobel Peace Prize. From some of you, there was a certain reverence about the award, which went straight up against the weekend pundits and all their cynicism.
My name is Michael Andre Adams. I'm calling from Atlanta, Georgia. I think it's a wonderful thing, and I think that as a country, we should be celebrating this. Instead, I'm hearing all the pundits coming out and trying to justify why or why not he should have gotten this award. It changes our image on an international platform. Isn't that what we wanted?
Some of the most interesting things came up when you tried to step inside the president's mind or the people that he's going to be dealing with.
My name is Sunny. I'm from Oklahoma. I'm concerned about how other countries are going to perceive this. I don't think they're going to like this because now everyone's going to think, oh, here's President Obama, Mr. Nobel Peace Prize.
Can't you hear that, though? Can't you hear that? He goes into, like, some world leader's, you know, office and he's like, hello, Mr. Peace Prize. And he's
like, maybe he'll carry it with him in a little box.
Okay, Mr. Peace Prize. Okay, that's how it's going to work. It's going to complicate his life.
Here's what Phil Mena from Westchester, New York says.
I think to give a sitting president, regardless of who they are, a Nobel Peace Prize is not appropriate. I think it could hinder his movements in the future.
You know, my intuition says I understand what she's saying there, but a lot of you objected to that whole idea. Kate from New York says, changing perceptions is exactly what's needed right now. And she emailed this to us. Not only is the Nobel Prize for President Obama a recognition of this new tone he's brought to the world, it's a recognition of a major shift in America itself. That we could elect a black president means over 50% of voters have had their fill of racism and injustice. That's a sea change for America's status and influence in the world. This year's Nobel Peace Prize is for all of us.
And here's a popular sentiment. It comes from Kevin from Oklahoma City.
You know, after 8 years of George Bush, what the world needed most was hope. And Barack Obama has provided that. So, yes, I think he deserves the Nobel Prize for Peace.
I don't know. Not being Bush is the reason for getting the prize.
I'm not even going to comment on that, John, because you're just trying to get me in trouble.
No, I'm not trying to get in trouble. I'm worried about the cynicism. What do you think, Ibrahim?
Well, I think it's kind of like Mark Sanchez, the quarterback for the Jets, winning three games, and everyone thinks he's going to win the Super Bowl after three games. Right. So it might be a little premature, but I trust you
to come up with a
sports metaphor. Let's get Sanchez on the phone, shall we? Keep the comments coming, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Coming up,
how does the healthcare bill become law?
Yes, we're going to look at the messy process. What'd you call it?
Like
making sausage.
Coming up, I'll take senators for 50, John. We're going to talk about Senator Max Baucus's health care bill. We're also going to talk to Senator Barbara Boxer about her new novel. But first, here are some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes past the hour. 41 are dead after a suicide bomb attack in northwest Pakistan. The strike targeted Pakistani troops. Meanwhile, Pakistan's military says it has new intelligence on a separate attack on army headquarters over the weekend. The military says attackers wanted to take top officers hostage to negotiate for the release of jailed militants. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for that attack. The Senate Finance Committee is set to vote on its health care bill tomorrow. It's just the next step in a very long process that will include a very tough battle in the full Senate.
And we haven't even talked about the House. In other health news, fears over H1N1 or swine flu are apparently causing record numbers of people to get the seasonal flu vaccine, and some doctors are experiencing shortages. In California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is calling a special session of lawmakers. They're focusing on the state's water problems. 12 hours of talks ended without any agreement. The question is how to pay for much-needed upgrades in the water system. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Northern Ireland, pushing rival leaders to continue working together. Number one stop on an extended trip. She heads to Russia later. And here's something interesting we found in China. Passengers there may soon be fined for riding with drunk drivers. The government wants the fines and increased jail time for repeat drunk drivers. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
listen to those congressmen arguing. Is all that discussion and debate about you?
Yeah, I'm one of the lucky ones. Most bills never even get this far. I hope they decide to report on me favorably, otherwise I may die.
Die?
Yeah, die in committee.
Well, it didn't die in committee. In fact, everyone's expecting tomorrow for the Senate Finance Committee to approve Max Baucus's health care bill, and then it gets out of committee, and then it moves into the full Senate. So we're going to get the details on exactly what goes on with this very messy process, often compared to making sausage. And joining us now to explain how this process works is David Kilpatrick. He's the Washington correspondent for our partners, the New York Times, and Dave Leventhal, communications director to the Center for Responsive Politics. That's a nonprofit watch group that tracks the influence of money on public policy. Good morning, both of you. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So, tracking the influence of money on public policy, Dave, that sounds like exactly what we need here to explain what has gone in, what got the axe, what is not in this bill, and what is in it. So let's talk about what actually did not make it into this bill.
Well, the thing is, when you think about health care reform, you think about insurance so often, but there are a whole variety of different things that different entities have been lobbying on over the past many months, and you have things like generic drug provisions. You have things like the public plan option, which are more high profile. But then you have other things like abortion issues. You have other elements too that are still being debated. The way that taxation is going to work, they're still being bandied about right now. So it's really just a huge piece of legislation that is being fought on many fronts here.
So, David Kilpatrick, you have to make sense of this for the New York Times all the time. So explain to me, what exactly is in this bill? Give me the 10-cent rundown. What are the points of this bill?
Oh, that'll be no problem at all. It's a 1,000-page bill, and I'll just rattle off 10 bullet points. No way. This thing is unbelievably complicated. We're talking about 1/6 of the American economy. So the ideas are, the core ideas are to do two things at once. One, extend insurance coverage to a lot of people who don't have it now, getting up to maybe 94 or 95%. No, not all of them. Would there be... not all of them in two groups. First, there's non-citizens, right? So people who are residents of the U.S. but not citizens don't get in. Nobody wants them in. And then there's some people who, even with subsidies, still won't be able to afford it, and there'll be some sort of exemption for them. But, 94, 95% of the country is pretty good compared to where we are now. But the trick is, and here's the tricky part, the promise of health care reform is to extend coverage, right, giving more money away, pumping federal money into the system, while at the same time, with the other hand, lowering the growth of costs overall. And the idea is you can go to these interest groups, the doctors, the hospitals, the drug makers, and say, look, we're about to give you a lot of new customers, and as part of the process, we're going to rejigger things so that costs don't keep going up forever and ever. So we got to change some of the ways that we all do business because costs are growing too fast, and this is the opportunity to do them. But there's an innate tension between pumping more money into the system by expanding coverage and at the same time slowing the growth of costs on the other side. And that other part, the slowing the growth of costs, that's what gets people upset. Nobody minds if the federal government wants to give away a lot more money to provide coverage to a lot of people. Everybody likes that. It's when you turn around and say, okay, and we'd also like to pay you a little bit less, that people start hiring lobbyists.
So, Dave Leventhal, you're at the Center for Responsive Politics. You track financial influence, and one of the things that's happened now is we have this new ad campaign saying that it doesn't matter what the Congressional Budget Office said. They said it's gonna save money for the government, but this new ad campaign says this is gonna cost people more if they have private insurance. What's the truth there?
Well, the fact of the matter is that this ad campaign it's come from every direction, and there may or may not be truth to any of the ads that you're seeing. The point is, though, that there are hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars being spent through advertising, through direct lobbying, through other means of influence to try to influence Congress on this. And when you have a bill that is so dense, you have a bill that is so far-reaching, you get the kind of money that's being spent here that is being spent. So is it surprising on one end? No, but we are seeing unprecedented amounts of money being spent on this single issue when compared to almost any other single issue that's been debated in Congress.
Okay, Dave Leventhal, Center for Responsive Politics, can you tell me a story of one thing that got axed out because of actions of lobbying?
Well, I think going back to the generic drugs issue, it's something that really has floated below the radar, but is a very important thing to the pharmaceutical and health products industry. Let's put this in perspective. The pharmaceutical and health products industry has spent $134.4 million, with just the first 6 months of this year having passed. And that's more than oil and gas has spent this year, more than the insurance industry, more than the electric utilities industry. And basically, you know, they were looking toward their bottom line and making sure that in the end that whatever bill is ultimately passed is not going to be something that's going to be detrimental to their ability to sell drugs for as long as they possibly can under their brand names. And that's just one example of where, in the end,
but
it looks
Dave,
like...
Dave, can I do the math? Can I do the math in the last second? It seems they spent $141 million by your estimate, and it looks like they will save themselves paying $103 billion by some estimates in the Medicare drug reimbursement, which is going to be at a higher level. So for $141 million, they save $103 billion. Is that about right?
And that's exactly the math that's at work on their side. They want to spend a penny now so they can save a dollar later.
David Kirkpatrick with our partner, the New York Times. This could all change completely now that we go, once we get into the full Senate, right?
And beyond, when we go into conference with the House. That's the big battle right now.
David Kirkpatrick is the Washington correspondent for our partners, the New York Times, and Dave Leventhal, communications director for the Center for Responsive Politics. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You know, there's no better way to sell albums than to get a creepy, brilliant, slightly eccentric pop star musician out of the way.
This is it. Here I stand. I'm the light of the world. I feel grand.
At the risk of offending just about everyone in the universe, that's Michael Jackson speaking from the grave there. Yes, he's still selling music. This is his live new single released over the weekend, This Is It, part of a sales juggernaut on its way to downloads and record stores all over the world. Maura Johnston, editor of the music blog Idolator, joins us from her home in Long Island City, New York. Maura, good morning.
Hello.
So, you know, it's not new that a deceased artist sells more records from, you know, beyond the grave than when they were alive. Hendrix did. Tupac actually did pretty well after his departure from this world. But what's unique about the Michael Jackson story?
Well, the Michael Jackson story is really interesting because right now, you know, we're in sort of a very down period for record sales in general. And actually right now, as of this moment, Michael Jackson's Number Ones is the top-selling album of 2009.
Wow.
It's sold about 1.9 million copies over the course of this year, which is 80,000 more than the Number Two album, which actually is an album from last year. It's Taylor Swift's Fearless. But so, you know, he's still moving records. He's still getting people to go to the music section of whatever big box store or, you know, the few remaining record stores that are out there.
Right. Maura, this is also a multimedia story in a sense, in that, you know, just like the Beatles, you know, video game, the rock band, the software that's being sold, people want to experience being the Beatles. In a sense, this isn't just about listening to the music. It's watching this concert that was put on videotape that is never going to be, but actually exists in media form. What do you think?
Well, you know, basically the movie is going to be constructed from hours and hours of rehearsal footage that was shot at the Staples Center in Los Angeles for the This Is It tour, which, you know, the song that we just heard is sort of conveniently named after. And it's, you know, it was supposed to be a 50-show run in London over the course of the summer. And Michael had said when the shows were initially announced over the winter that this was going to be his sort of last hurrah swan song. And so basically what happened was Sony paid about $60 million for the rights to all this footage. Hmm. And Kenny Ortega, who was the choreographer and director of the show, who also worked on, like, High School Musical, he was charged with editing together all of the footage for release, and then it's landing in theaters on the 28th.
John, I can't figure out if it's insulting if you're an artist right now and you get beat out by a dead guy, or if it just speaks to the power of Michael Jackson's name that his album is number one. Maura, what is this about? Is this about your blog is Idolator? Is this about just the cachet of Michael Jackson?
Yeah, you know, Michael Jackson was sort of like the last huge pop star. I mean, he was someone who united people from different genres, fans of different types of music. And, you know, I mean, when he died, his music was ubiquitous, and that really didn't change in the aftermath of his death. I mean, I still hear his songs all over the place. And, you know, especially now with music sort of fragmenting and people listening to whatever's on their iPods and being happy with that, Michael Jackson's someone who can unite a lot of people.
Well, he certainly united the family by getting as much money out of the estate as they possibly can. They even granted a permission for a reprint of that 1988 autobiography by Michael Jackson, Moonwalk. Maura Johnston, thanks so much. She's the editor of the music blog Idolator, all about the release of the Michael Jackson single, This Is It.
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. So Senator Barbara Boxer, the discussion with her about her new novel, tell me if this sounds familiar, John, a powerful and influential experienced female senator talking about her day-to-day life on Capitol Hill.
That's the plot
of her new book. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes.
Wow.
We're also talking about President Obama because he's got a few months to write his speech, his acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize. He's gotten lots of praise. He's gotten lots of criticism. And we're asking you, what would you say at the acceptance speech?
I think Obama should just celebrate and yell out, hey, no one's throwing shoes at me.
Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now we'll take a look at some of the top stories we're following this morning. In Pakistan, 41 are dead after a suicide car bomb in the Swat area. Pakistani troops were the target. Staying abroad, North Korea has test-fired 5 missiles off its east coast, according to South Korean media.
American Eleanor Ostrom is the first woman to win the Nobel Prize for Economics. She shares the prize with another American. Some doctors say they're running low on seasonal flu vaccine. Fears about H1N1 or swine flu are apparently pushing people to get the seasonal vaccine in record numbers. Reverend Al Sharpton wants the NFL to block Rush Limbaugh from buying the St. Louis Rams. Sharpton says the radio talker is too divisive and would be bad for the league. And staying with sports, the Philadelphia Phillies and the Colorado Rockies play game 4 of their playoff series today. The Phillies lead 2-1, and later this week, the New York Yankees and the Los Angeles Angels are going to face off for the AL League Championship. Looking ahead to tomorrow, the Senate Finance Committee is expected to vote on that health care reform bill. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, most people recognize the name Barbara Boxer as a senator and chair, perhaps, of the Environment and Public Works Committee, but also she is a novelist. Her new thriller is called Blind Trust. It's in bookstores now, and she joined us earlier this morning to talk about it. I asked her first, why did she choose to write fiction, something that can be critically reviewed or praised? Why did she even open herself up to that?
I like to write. It's just what I like to do. I have colleagues who like to golf, and some like to paint. My colleague, Senator Feinstein, does beautiful artwork. I like to write. And, you know, I think my constituents at home know that that you have to elect a person who has maybe some varied skills and talents. And I used to write a column for a weekly paper. I've also written nonfiction, but I love to write fiction. I teamed up with a partner on this one and the one before. And it is funny to see the critics. I sort of laugh about it, but to me, it's great fun, and I can do things, I could say things in fiction that I couldn't say in nonfiction.
Well, you know, the lead character, the main character in this book, is also happens to be a female senator.
Yes, she is.
But she gets accused of ethics violations. Mm-hmm. Were you worried that people were going to connect her to you?
Well, Ellen Fisher is my idol. The way she handles her life, and I aspire to be like her. What happens to her, she's in the pinnacle of her power, and she's about to investigate surveillance and other things that are happening from the administration, and she becomes a target of the right wing, so they make up all sorts of things about her.
That never
they
happens.
Go after
That's
her.
Ridiculous.
They go after her staff. And I wanted my readers to really see, you know, how much is on the line here when you begin to gain power. So it's very cathartic for me to write fiction.
So let's actually talk about what's on the line for you in your position of power, because we've been talking a lot on the global stage about climate change, and obviously you are the chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee. There's this Boxer Kerry bill on the table there. So what is your strategy for actually getting your 60 votes to get this passed?
I have a very good strategy. It's called One Day at a Time. And the next step is to get it out of my committee. And that's where I'm totally focused. John Kerry, who's been a wonderful partner in all of this, he's not on the committee. So his strategy right now is to work to get support off the committee. So yesterday he had a op-ed piece ran in the it ran in the New York Times with Lindsey Graham, which is the first Republican to actually come out and say, yes, I want to work on this. That was a big breakthrough. So the strategy is to build our coalition stronger and stronger. We have worked with the faith groups because the faith groups are looking at this global warming situation and saying, you know, if we care about God's green earth, we have to speak out. And they are really coming forward in numbers. We're very pleased to add them. We have, you know, people who are working on natural gas. They see that, you know, they have a product that has half the carbon emissions. So we're building some very interesting coalitions, and that's the strategy.
Well, you're certainly, no one would argue that you're one of the progressive Democrats in the Senate, and if we're talking about the whole Democratic
caucus. And very proud of it.
And very proud of it, sure. Yes. But does that put you on the front line in 2010? Are you vulnerable from the criticism?
Yeah, well, sure. I'm vulnerable every single time I run. And my right-wing friends always say, Barbara Boxer, are we going to just knock her off? And so I'm running for my 11th election, and I hope to win it. But of course I'm on the line, but that's who I am, and I expect that.
Is former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina, who might be your challenger, a right-wing extremist?
Well, she's totally anti-choice. She wants to drill off the coast of California. So she has a lot of positions that don't mesh with the people of my state. But beyond that, she's someone who didn't vote in 75% of the elections since she moved to California. So there's other issues. And, you know, my view is these are very tough times. And who do you really want in the Senate? Somebody who's going to stand up and fight, who's always done that from day one, or someone who's untested, who didn't even vote in most of the elections. And so it's going to be a very intriguing race, expensive race.
I have to ask you, because although you and Senator Kerry have kind of shied away from using the phrase cap and trade, but the cap and trade idea, where it's almost like buying an indulgence from the Catholic Church. You have a wealthy corporation that's going to pay a lot of money so that they can continue with their practices when somebody else gets cleaner. That seems to a lot of environmentalists like a bad deal for the environment. But even that, you're having trouble getting through the Republicans in the Senate. And if you can't even get cap and trade through, how are you going to get any kind of meaningful environmental change coming out of Congress?
Well, first of all, the cap and trade, which we call it pollution reduction and investment.
Way more snappy.
Well, cap and trade sounds like a baseball term. You put a cap on a player and you trade him. Most people don't get it. You do. Bless your heart. But first of all, it did pass the House, number one. Number two, the environmentalists pretty much all embrace it at this point. And I think that we can do it because it gives us flexibility as we reduce the carbon out of the air. And it's, you know, it's not that many firms that are going to have to pay this, that are going to have to do this. So we feel it's the most flexible way to reduce this pollution, and we think it's going to work. It worked for acid rain, the same type of plan, and we think it will work for this.
So the other big issue on Capitol Hill is Afghanistan. You said before that you hadn't made up your mind about the troop increase in Afghanistan. Have you changed?
I didn't say that. I said I wanted, before I spoke out on it, I wanted to see what the president said. But here's what I believe. We have enough troops there to fight the Taliban. If you count our 68,000 troops, the 30,000 plus troops of NATO, the 100,000 troops of the Afghans, and we're going to train another 94,000. That's well over 200,000 versus 20,000 Taliban. And thankfully, Al-Qaeda is really on the ropes and they're way down. So I don't think it's a question of the number of troops. I think people get off on that. It's wrong. The question is the strategy. And that's what has to change, not the number of troops.
Barbara Boxer, California Democratic Senator in our studios here. Your book, Blind Trust. Did you ever read the book, Advise and Consent?
Oh, of course.
Okay, that paints a picture of a nasty, awful place called Washington. This is, while there's some nasty and awful people, this is a kind of heroic, roll-up-your-sleeves kind of place. Do you believe that Washington is that way?
Well, you've got the good and the bad, and I try to show, you know, some goodness there, and I try to show the truth is that no place is all bad and no place is all good. You know that right here in the studio.
Yeah, it's bad
you've got
in the
good,
studio here.
You've got the good and the bad and the who knows. And what I try to show is the staff and how hard they work and how good they are.
Senator Barbara Boxer, Democrat from California and author of the new thriller, Blind Trust.
If you want to re-listen to Senator Boxer or anything else on The Takeaway, you can take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. And we've been asking for your suggestions for President Obama, who has a Nobel Peace Prize speech to write.
This is Ian. I'm calling from Columbia, South Carolina. I think this isn't about his success as a president. It's about whether or not he's affected peace in the world. From the word go, he's opposed every major conflict except for those that were justified, like voting against the Iraq War from the very beginning. And I think his actions have shown that he's very dedicated to peace.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org. And if I just step out of line even the tiniest bit.
Hello, this is Adele from Seattle, Washington. If I were writing the speech, I would say, John Hockenberry, get over it. Thanks.
Get over it, John Hockenberry.
I've never been mentioned in a Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech.
That would be quite the thing.
I would be thrilled if that were to happen. No more cynicism. I'm out of here for 3 days. You're solo till Friday.
That's right. So they can say, Celeste Headlee, get over it. 877-8-MY-TAKE is where you say that. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.